From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's time for the best of Only a Game. Just ahead, golfing legend Gary Player reflects on the passing of Augusta National's infamous Eisenhower tree. Also, baseball recreations in movies based on Raymond Chandler's novels. Billie Jean King talks about the state of women's sports, a Christmas caroling competition in Frosty, Florida, and pitcher for life Bill Lee helps Only a Game celebrate our 20th anniversary. Also ahead, Julius Erving discusses his Hall of Fame basketball career and his abilities as a team player and, when necessary, as a freelancer.
Ultimately, I think my skills as a basketball player led some of my coaches to give me a green light. And Kevin Lockery probably was the best at it. He would say, man, the game plan is not working. Would you just go do something out there for us?
Stay tuned. Thank you. Thank you very much. In May of 2014, Only a Game celebrated its 20th anniversary live on stage at the Somerville Theater just outside of Boston. It mattered little to us that our very first show was actually broadcast on July 24th, 1993, and we felt it would be good to invite the star of our very first story, which featured the New England Gray Sox barnstorming baseball team, to celebrate with us. The team included former Boston Red Sox players Jim Lonborg and Bernie Carbo, but the real reason to go to a Gray Sox game was the team's player, manager, promoter, who from an early age seemed destined, at least as he recalls it, for stardom in Boston.
My dad said, you're Irish, you're Catholic, and you drink a lot. You're going to go far in the Red Sox organization.
20 years and 10 months after Only a Game first shouldered its way onto the airwaves, we welcomed back the star of our very first feature, Bill Lee.
We thought it would be this long. Seems like yesterday, but I made this for Bill. It says, Bill Littlefield, Only a Game, 25th anniversary.
Whoa!
You can open it in 5 years.
Excellent. Excellent.
That's fine. So Nick Ortiz is back.
That actually gives me the opportunity to remember when Bill Lee won 21 games 3 years in a row. Oh, no, wait, it was 17 games 3 years in a row.
So I won 54 games in 1 year.
There you go.
I was 54-1, and Brad Park dropped a pop fly. And it dropped, and the guy, ball hit the ground, and the next guy hit a three-run homer.
Uh-oh.
And that was my only loss. And Brad was so upset, and I said, Brad, it's only a game.
So I've been looking, and that's not even in the script. That's
Trust
incredible.
Me. I have nothing on a script.
We started with that little bit of sound in which your father predicted that you would go far in the Red Sox organization, and you did go far in the Red Sox organization.
Not
but
far enough.
Was it not far enough?
No, I should still be playing.
Ah.
Yeah, at 65, I pitched a complete game for the San Rafael Pacifics. And I didn't have really good stuff, and I didn't have good command, and the catcher was a young guy. And I said, here's what we're going to do. You're not going to call any signs, because you're probably not going to catch them anyway. And I worked my tempo, and I ended up going 9 innings. It was amazing. I got a base hit, an RBI, and I'm the oldest guy. I beat Satchel Paige by 7 years. He was 59, I was 65.
There you go.
So I'm blessed. Now, I pitched Bill, 6 innings yesterday. I'm not going to let you talk. It's on the script.
It's fine. You made it to the World Series in 75. Red Sox didn't win that year, but they won in 2004, 2007, 2013. I have to imagine that you were watching at least some of that. What was going through your mind?
Well, what's the last thing goes through a bug's mind when it hits a windshield?
They won!
I know. I was in Hawaii with Charles Lacuadera. So, Chucky and I, we go to this bar, and we're down three, and Robert steals second, and we win the ball game, and we come back happy, drunk like crazy. We go to the next game, we win that game, and there were half as many Yankee fans. When we won the fourth game, there was 2 Yankee fans in the bar. And I'm telling you, I was in Hawaii, I married off my oldest daughter, and it was a good day.
As I mentioned, we first caught up with you in the summer of 93. You were barnstorming with the Gray Sox at that point. And this is what you told a group of kids before the game against the Cape Cod League's Falmouth Commodores.
When you're finished with this game, I want you all to run back to your houses. And on the way, find 2 5-pound rocks. Because when I come up in the morning, after I stretch, I grab rocks and I go down and get the mail and I go like this. What does that do? It builds my upper body.
You really did that.
I did it today. I drove 222 miles, and every 15 minutes, I have a 2.5-pound little rubber ball I squeeze, and I do that. And that's why I threw six. I hadn't picked up a ball in 45 days, and I went out and threw 6 innings yesterday against Middlebury. I struck out 9, and I got a base hit, 2 RBIs. And the guys, how you do it is picking up them little rocks.
There you go.
Every day. Well, don't worry about throwing. Worry about deceleration of your rotator cuff.
You know, I was going to close this down by asking you what you were up to today, but we know you're still pitching.
I make bats, I make wine, I pitch, and I pick up them rocks.
Yeah, you go. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to see you again.
We're working on getting Bernie Carvo and Jim Lonborg to join us for our 25th anniversary celebration at an as-yet-undetermined location. We hope the Zambonis can once again provide the music and the hockey gear.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
We are radiating in Marconi's realm, true, but we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Please check us out at facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. Only a Game NPR is also our Twitter handle. Author Raymond Chandler produced a string of novels and short stories, many featuring legendary private detective Philip Marlowe. Those works were fiction, but one Chandler book offers a brief glimpse into a real but bygone era of baseball. In October of 2013, Only a Game's Doug Tribou shared a bit of hard-boiled hardball history, courtesy of a legendary mystery writer.
You're on the air, Marlowe. Tell it to him.
Were you going to say something?
Go ahead.
There are a few things Philip Marlowe will never pass up. A smoke, a glass of bourbon, and a little conversation.
You wanted to see me?
So you're a private detective. I didn't know they existed except in books, or else they were greasy little men snooping around hotel corridors.
Humphrey Bogart brought Raymond Chandler's ace detective to life in The Big Sleep. Marlowe was hot on the trail of a case and Lauren Bacall. But in Chandler's novel The High Window, Marlowe is after a rare coin known as the Brasher Doubloon. The plot does more twisting than Chubby Checker. Marlowe pays a visit to another detective and notices a Dodgers game is on the radio in the apartment across the hall. Marlowe describes the scene. I knocked, got no answer, and knocked louder. Behind my back, 3 Dodgers struck out against a welter of synthetic crowd noise. Hang on, synthetic crowd noise? Sounds fishy. Plus, the book's set in Pasadena and Los Angeles. The High Window was published in 1942. That's 16 years before the Brooklyn Dodgers migrated west to California. Yet, Chandler chose to mention them.
Oh. Any reason given?
Not that I know of.
Well, Chandler gives us another clue when he mentions that the broadcast is a recreated ballgame. Not a replay, but a recreation.
All of us have grown up accepting with little question certain images as accurate portraits of public figures. Seldom, if ever, do we ask if the images are true to the original.
Good point, Mr. President. And Ronald Reagan would know. In the 1930s, Reagan worked as a radio sportscaster. The future actor, governor, and president recreated Chicago Cubs games for WHO in Des Moines, Iowa.
Someday it might be worthwhile to find out how images are created.
Hey, that's a good idea. From the 1920s, well into the 1950s, radio stations started recreating games for same-day delayed broadcasts. Jim Williams worked on dozens of minor league baseball recreations for KVVC in Ventura, California, in 1951 and 52.
It was very expensive to rent telephone lines for several hundred miles and to also send sportscasters from, say, Ventura to Modesto.
Ventura had a team in the California League. Williams was just beginning a long radio career when he served as the sound engineer for recreated road games.
We had a telegrapher from the Western Union office who came to the radio station in Ventura. His counterpart would be at the stadium in Modesto, and then he would type out a few dots and dashes and send a brief message to our telegrapher.
Who typed up the action one half inning at a time.
Smith, strike one, low. Ball two, hit the center field. Caught by Sam Jones.
The announcer in Ventura would then call the game, adding color with statistics and other details. Williams would play sound effects records to round out the production.
Booing, crowds cheering, people running around selling popcorn. Get your fresh popcorn here. Get your Red Hots here. Get your Coke here.
And there was a wooden bat hanging near the announcer's microphone.
If there was a hit, he would simply take his wooden ruler and hit the bat extending from the ceiling. You hear the crack of the bat on the wood.
And the sportscaster also had a baseball and a glove.
And that's how we did it.
The master of the art form was Gordon McClendon.
What makes you say that?
From 1947 to 1952, McClendon and his Liberty Broadcasting System delivered elaborate Major League recreations from his studio in Dallas. At its peak, Liberty had nearly 500 affiliate stations, mainly in the West and South, where there were no big league teams.
I hate to let this guy get away with it.
Actually, most stations acknowledged the broadcasts were recreations in announcements before and after the games. The biggest concern was a broken telegraph or human error at the ballpark. Again, former KVVC sound engineer Jim Williams.
Modesto came to bat. They had an inning, and they had four outs, and they went down. Then they came right back up to bat again. That does not happen in a ball game.
The announcer in Ventura started filling time, eventually announcing a fake storm and rain delay, while the telegrapher phoned the press box in Modesto.
Well, when the telegrapher came on the horn on the telephone, he was drunk.
The staff in Ventura had a newspaper reporter at the stadium give them a summary over the phone after each half inning.
Our sportscaster came on and said, well, the storm is now over. Let's get back to the game. And so that was a hair-pulling time. It never happened again. And I would assume that the telegrapher in Modesto got fired, too.
The 1947 film adaptation of The High Window was called The Brasher Doubloon and starred George Montgomery as Marlowe. The Dodgers recreation is not in the movie, but the book offers one more historically accurate tidbit. After Marlowe finds the other private eye dead, a neighbor ties his alibi to the length of the baseball broadcast. And Chandler got it right. His estimate would put a game at about 2.5 hours, pretty much in line for the era, and significantly shorter than today's nearly 3-hour average. So that's the story of what Raymond Chandler can teach us about baseball history. And I better wrap this up before it turns into a long goodbye.
Good. We'll take a short recess.
Oh, I don't think I need one.
I do.
Me too. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, my conversation with Dr. J. It'll be a slam dunk, I promise. Did I really say that? But first...
There are many, many stories that have built up over the years of kids being asked questions in Harlem as they carry a little cross stick on the subway, including, what is that thing, a fishing pole?
Charles Gildahouse, a board member of an organization called Harlem Lacrosse and Leadership, is one of the people responsible for children in Harlem mystifying their friends on the subway. Gildahouse is also president of the youth lacrosse organization in Concord, Massachusetts, where he and his family live. He spoke with me in November of 2013 on the lacrosse field at Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School. There, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade boys from Concord and some of Boston's other western suburbs had formed teams with players from Harlem's Frederick Douglass Academy.
Because we've done this trip 4 years in a row, the word Concord, they tell me, down in the schools, is almost a mythical word, that you get to go on the Concord trip this year. And the teachers have told me whenever they need to get the attention of the kids in class, they say one word, Concord, and silence, and everyone looks around.
Concord may have mythical implications now, but according to Charles Gildahouse's wife, Pamela, a driving force in the event they call the One Nation Tournament, at first, the trip just seemed scary.
We picked the kids up. They arrived in Concord in the pitch black, and they got off the bus, and everyone was quiet, shy, and very fearful. And we put them in our car. And they looked out the window at all the trees, and this one boy said, "Oh my gosh, are there wolves in these forests?" And then I pulled the car up into the garage, and another one said, "You put the car right inside the house?"
During her first experience hosting the boys from New York, Pamela Gildahouse and her husband took in 12 lacrosse players. Ms. Gildahouse became concerned about the only one of the dozen who wasn't active and loud.
And this one boy was sitting really quietly in a chair reading a book. And I said, "Are you okay? And he said, "No, I'm just in the middle of a really great book." And my daughter, who was 11 at the time, said, "Oh my gosh, I'm reading the same book."
Thus did the hosts and the visitors begin learning they had more in common than enthusiasm for lacrosse. And according to Charles Gildahouse, the program, which includes mentoring and academic tutoring, has helped generate better grades, higher test scores, and improved self-discipline among the students from New York, some of whom he characterized as at risk.
So teams 3 and 6 made here. Yes, right?
Okay.
So
you move up.
On the field on that wet and windy Sunday, Andrew, a Wellesley resident who said he'd been playing lacrosse for 6 years, was praising the skills of a New Yorker named Elijah and his friends, who'd first picked up sticks just a couple of months ago.
I mean, they're doing amazing. If I had to guess, if I didn't know how long they've been playing, I would guess like a few years. I mean, they're amazing.
How's that make you feel?
Good.
I asked Elijah whether competing with the more experienced Massachusetts players was a challenge.
Well, he's on my team, so.
You're smiling. I guess you think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right.
Two fields over, a youngster named Jordan, who lived in the Bronx, had taken a break from the game just to look around.
Well, it's really nice, very quiet, has beautiful little land, like nice tall trees and all that.
Jordan hadn't been playing lacrosse for long, but he'd already been encouraged to see the game as an opportunity.
I plan to go to high school and play it so that I could get an opportunity for college or something like that, or get a professional career in it.
The children from Harlem and the Bronx are not the only players who've experienced away games. Some of the Massachusetts players have traveled by van to the Frederick Douglass Academy in Harlem, where, according to Pamela Gildahouse, their eyes got as big as saucers.
The whole experience was just eye-opening for everybody. I mean, a lot of the chaperones, too. They pulled into the FDA school, and, you know, there are big gates locked behind the vans. And they got inside, and, you know, they were met with just a very warm welcome.
The One Nation Tournament is an annual event. The contact between the lacrosse players in Massachusetts and those from New York is necessarily fleeting. Though the program has raised considerable scholarship money for the students at the Frederick Douglass Academy, it may be that its most significant achievement is impossible to quantify. Pamela Gildahouse talked about that achievement as the lacrosse games went on around us and the wind tried to scatter her words.
They really find a spot in our hearts. Some of them have very complicated lives. Some of them have, you know, a fabulous mom and a fabulous dad, and they're really involved and very supportive. And other kids have a more complicated family life. And I think they're just excited to make friends and meet new people who care about them.
It is appropriate that Dr. J, the autobiography of Julius Irving, begins with these three words, "Rise, I jump." Above all, often literally, Julius Irving was known for the way he seemed to hang in the air as gravity pulled all the other basketball players toward the floor. In November of 2013, I was joined by Julius Irving, who talked about his image as the NBA's ultimate freelancer.
Yeah, but freelance within a system. Ultimately, I think my skills as a basketball player led some of my coaches to give me a green light. And once you're green lit, it's like back to the playground. It's back to the playground. But we had plays and we had defensive schemes and, you know, we had all that. And Kevin Lockery probably was the best at it. He would say, "Man, the game plan is not working. Would you just go do something out there for us?" and I would revel in that. I used to love it.
When did it first occur to you that you could fly?
Probably when I got to high school, and I dunked the ball in a basketball game as a junior, and I was one of the players who was coming off the bench. And I became a starter shortly after that. But there was a play coming down court, and, you know, nobody really dunked the ball except for the oversized guys in warm-ups. And I left from inside the foul line, and I actually jumped to, you know, kind of finger roll the ball into the basket, and I found myself over the rim when I got to the basket, and all I could do was throw it down. And it was my momentum that forced this play. So it was, if it was something that I planned and I missed, I was coming out of the game. You know, the crowd went crazy. You know, the coach gave a sign of approval. And that was probably the first time I felt like I had flown.
You starred in the American Basketball Association, won two championships with the New York Nets before becoming the object of one of the most confusing contract squabbles that I've ever encountered. How did it happen that two ABA teams and two NBA teams all claimed that you should be wearing their uniform?
How much time you got? It was a little crazy. I mean, yeah, I'm playing for Virginia. I signed with Atlanta. I'm drafted by Milwaukee. And after one more year in Virginia, I end up playing with the New York Nets, which was more like a league-generated deal to keep me in the ABA. So, you know, I would play for their signature franchise, which was a New York franchise. And, you know, it's good to be a free agent, but I wasn't exactly free agent. You know,
no, the courts were involved with this.
Yeah, the courts were involved, and mediation was involved. And it was a mess, but we do sort it out in the book. I think we sort it out, and we kind of make it work for the reader. So I won't try and elaborate on in depth and detail. We really don't have time for that.
You are candid in the book about your relationships with women. At one point, you say of your failure to be faithful to your college girlfriend, and again, I'm quoting here, "It depletes my soul, this philandering." But it doesn't stop, this philandering, for quite a while after you offer that observation. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Maybe mom playing mother and father left that part out in terms of, you know, really having that frank discussion. And in the 50s and the 60s, I'm not sure if parents, you know, talk to their children a whole lot about sex and put you on the right path in terms of really appreciating the opposite sex, you know, for what they were and how they should be appreciated. And so I think when you get on the wrong path early, it's hard to get on the right path. And for me, yeah, it's one of those difficulties that I admit for the sake of helping to encourage others and advise others to really get a keen understanding, you know, before you deal with intimacy with the opposite sex about, you know, feelings and certainly about responsibility and about consequences.
Given that you played against Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan, and you played with Moses Malone, it's fascinating that in the autobiography you say it's Pete Maravich who's the most skilled player you've ever seen. Make the case for Pete Maravich.
Well, the long, skinny kid with the floppy socks who just had the ball in his hand like a yo-yo on a string, and there was no string there. I mean, in terms of passing, nobody could thread the needle better. Nobody could see the court better and deliver a pass, whether it's orthodox or unorthodox. But, you know, when Pete was scoring 44 points a night at LSU and even with the Atlanta Hawks and the New Orleans Jazz, you know, he could step inside of half court and let it go. And you better believe most of them were going to go in.
My guest is Julius Erving. In the book, you write about the death of your son, Corey, who drowned after a car accident in Florida in 2000. He was 19. Was writing about that therapeutic for you?
Yes and no. It wasn't the purpose for writing the book, but as one of the takeaways after the book was written and now doing a book tour and talking about it, I feel some sense of relief. A lot of that period is a blur for me, and it comes across, I think, in the book in terms of that stage in my life, you know, not being as crystal clear as the earlier years. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what to say about it other than it's the worst nightmare for any parent or any sibling, and it happened to us.
In addition to your two ABA titles with the Nets, you went on to win an NBA championship with the 76ers back in '83. Larry Bird has often spoken about how he felt he and his Celtics teammates should have won more titles given the composition of that team. I wonder, looking back, do you feel the same way about the Philadelphia teams of that era?
Absolutely. At least one. You know, the initial team that we had in Philadelphia, if that team had stayed intact, because the team in its first year together, you know, had the best record in the league, went all the way through the playoffs, and then lost 4-2 to Portland, with them winning the last four games after we won the first two. Mm-hmm. So fixing that team, and maybe even staying with their coach, because he got fired the next season, would have given us a chance to redeem ourselves. And it was like starting new. And we ended up, you know, making the finals three times in the first 6 years that I was in Philadelphia, and losing all three times. So I think that at least one of those times we probably could have secured a championship.
Must have been a gigantic relief to finally win that one in Philadelphia, though.
Yeah, it's year seven, and to have that happen, it was a tremendous relief. I had really felt a lot of pressure. And, you know, even made some statements that, you know, I have no thoughts of retiring. I'll play as long as I can, as long as I have to, you know, to bring a championship to Philadelphia.
In addition to your new book, you have a company that manages your various business interests. I'm curious about what's next for Julius Erving.
We will take the good ride, you know, from age 63 to whenever retirement seems relevant and, you know, worthy of undertaking, because that's an undertaking. And I think with the team that I've assembled and with the family that I have, since I have a young family, as long as I'm raising them, you know, they got to keep me young, and I got to give them the guidance that's necessary to go out and take on the world and make their own mark in the world. That's kind of like the priorities right now, certainly the family first, and then what I do business-wise. And I will remain active in the public and as a strategic advisor to the 76ers, you know, I'll be spending a lot of time in Philadelphia.
With Carl Taro Greenfeld, Julius Erving has written Dr. J, the Autobiography. Julius, thank you very much for speaking with me. It was a delight.
Thank you. Mutual delight.
In June of 2014, the Oakland City Council passed a measure lifting a ban on one of the most corrupt undertakings that city had ever seen, namely the playing of pinball. Now Wizards and Flipper Files can ring the bells and rack up the bonus points without breaking the law. Beau Moore wrote about that development for Wired, and I asked him why Oakland had banned pinball in the first place.
The ban dates back to the 1930s, where not just Oakland, but actually across the country, a lot of places banned pinball. Pinball was originally a game more of chance than of skill before the addition of flippers. You basically just kind of dropped your ball in at a different spot and tried to rack up as many points as you can, and the machine operators would offer payouts for hitting a certain score. So it was a form of gambling, actually, and as such, the government viewed it as a nuisance, and they banned it.
Were those bans on pinball ever enforced?
They were. There's actually a kind of urban legend, but possibly true story, of officials in New York going in and wrecking up a bunch of pinball machines and drowning them in the river.
I have this image of Oaklanders and others at pinball speakeasies nudging and tilting during pinball's outlaw days, but maybe that's a little exaggerated.
Maybe a little bit, but yeah, but maybe they have a little plunger that you have to pull to get in the speakeasy.
According to your Wired article, Roger Sharp, the co-founder of the International Flipper Pinball Association, was instrumental in destigmatizing pinball back in the 70s, which has led eventually to the removal of the ban in Oakland. How did Mr. Sharp do that?
So Mr. Sharp, he went before the New York City Council in 1976. He went in and he played pinball in front of the city council. He showed them, I'm going to shoot a ball right here, and he did it. I'm going to hit the ball this way. I'm going to do this skill shot and prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that pinball is a game of skill, not of chance.
The Oakland City Council having seen the light, or flashing lights, as it were, do we now see this spread across the country? Does pinball enjoy a great boom?
Well, it does. So the thing is that the bans mostly have gone unenforced for a while now. Having said that, they are still sitting on the books. They're like these old outdated laws that, you know, like it's illegal to have an ice cream cone in your back pocket or to...
On Sunday.
You know, yeah, on Sunday, or to tie your camel up to a parking meter, you know.
Beaumore is a Wired contributor. You can link to his article, Huge Tournament Celebrates End of Oakland's Bizarre 80-Year Pinball Ban, at onlyagame.org. Bo, thank you for speaking with me. You did not tilt, and therefore you rack up many bonus points.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Gary Player discusses the much maligned and now much missed Eisenhower Tree at Augusta National Golf Club. But first, Tennis Hall of Famer and People's Rights champion Billie Jean King was tapped to deliver the commencement address to the all-female undergraduate class of 2014 at Simmons College in Boston. Only a Game's Karen Given caught up with King and began their conversation by asking her what she planned to say to the graduates.
That's a good question. Sometimes I'll just change a speech. I just feel the audience and just go. But basically, the three things I'll be talking about, the three main things, is that relationships are everything. That's number one. And it doesn't have to be in this order necessarily. Keep learning. Keep learning how to learn. And also to be a problem solver. I found those three things, and there's other things, but those are three main things that I've found, that people who have inner success as well as outer success, those three things seem to be very high in their list and why they do well, I think, in life.
Are there things that you can tell to graduates, and especially female graduates, that you can't imagine a graduation speaker saying to them 40 years ago?
I don't know, because I didn't hear speakers 40 years ago, but I think one of the things that bothers me a lot with women is that, for instance, if I'm in a cocktail party, if I say, what do you do, they think I mean sports, which I don't. I just want to know, you know, do you like theater? Do you like, what do you like? Read? What do you read? But they'll say, oh, I'm a terrible athlete. But men never say that to me. And we tend to say sorry all the time. And I catch myself always kind of like belittling myself a little instead of being positive and being confident. We need more women in leadership positions. You know, we're not even to 20% in Congress. We're like 19.8% or something. And, you know, it's just phenomenal to think that the United States of America in 2014, that we're not doing better than that, that we're making 77 cents on the dollar for women. It's just, we really have to change that. Women have to change it, but just as importantly, in fact, probably more importantly, men have to change that. We have to really fight for equality and inclusion of everyone.
Well, let's talk about the things you've done to fight for equality for women in sports. 40 years ago, you did something that forever changed the way that women are seen in sports. Are there still disappointments about how far we've come since the battle of the sexes?
Oh, we're not even scratching the surface. We don't have the opportunities at the professional level. And if you take women's sports, women's high school is exactly where the boys were in 1971 and 72. And everybody thinks we've arrived and we're equal. We're not. So we have 1.3 million less opportunities in high school than the boys. So everyone out there, it's not what you think it is. The perception is, I would say, better, much better than it is in reality.
You went to Sochi for the Olympics this year as part of the delegation. And, of course, Russia has anti-gay legislation, which was a big deal. Do you feel like your visit meant something to the people of Russia?
I met some people, and I met some LGBT people, and they said it did. But it only is a moment you're there. I would love to be able to get people out of Russia, really, if they need to get out, gay or otherwise. Oh, it's terrible. No, I talk with some of the gays. They're bullied every day. If their families are homophobic, they don't have a safe place at home. They don't have a safe place at school. They're not safe. There's so much bullying going on. I mean, I met this one boy that said that his family is basically turning against him. He goes to school. They hit him. He's almost been raped. You know that you just speak to one that's dealing with that. There's thousands dealing with that. So because of the anti-gay legislation, people have gotten the okay to be bullies and to be horrible to us. It was tough. A lot of people in the U.S. thought we should not go at all. I think it's better to go and show up. I'm a big believer in that. Just like going to the Middle East when we had the women's tennis championships in Doha, everybody was calling me, why are you going over there with the way the women's laws are? I said, that's why we need to go over there. We need to be seen. We need to be heard. We need to show there's different ways for both men and women to live their lives and have choices. So I think it's very important to go and not ignore.
What about closer to home? Jason Collins debuted in the NBA this year. Michael Sam might be drafted in the NFL this weekend. Why has it taken so long for these milestones to happen?
Because we've been scared and we want to be accepted when we finally come out. And you have to remember, the chemistry in a locker room is very fragile. It just is. It's a sensitive place. It's where people are together, they're under stress, they want to win. There's a certain culture that's been created around it. And for men, it's the macho culture. That's the epitome, especially football. It's very important that the straight athletes support the gays because they have the power just in numbers. So we need straight quarterbacks, for instance, to come out and say, get over it. They're our team players. As long as they do their job, I don't care how they live their life as far away from the football field. And that's the way it should be for everyone. One by one, it's been a real grassroots movement, the LGBT movement. One by one, coming out to your mom, your dad, to a friend. See, you've got to feel safe. That's the major thing. Accepted and safe. And if you don't feel like you're going to be safe, it's very hard to come out.
Well, Billie Jean King, I know you have to go give a commencement address right now. So thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much.
Only a Game's Karen Given talking with tennis great Billie Jean King before her 2014 commencement address at Simmons College in Boston. For those whose holiday entertainment includes sports, college bowl games, basketball, and ice hockey are the traditional fare. But for almost three decades, folks in Florida have come out to see a sport of the singing variety. In December of 2013, reporter Phil Latzman and his Slay team set out for Coral Gables to take in a caroling competition that has become one of Florida's spirited annual traditions.
The defending champions are warming up on the sidelines. The Hialeah High School Thoroughbreds are a show choir that has won their division of the caroling competition the past 14 years, and they have the swagger of a champion.
You guys want to win this thing?
Yeah! I mean, we definitely see this competition because, you know, we see other groups sometimes and we see they're good, so we're just like, we're always trying to be the best as we can be.
Let's see, a football game, you'll see it, but you might not remember it as much as a chorus show. The jingles will stay in there. You know they will.
That's so true. Definitely.
Jessica Peralta and Andy Villarreal are key players in the choir, led by head coach, or rather chorale director and English teacher, Ishmael Gonzalez, who has participated in this event all 27 years of its existence. Gonzalez says singing and athletics do have similar routines.
You have to concentrate, you have to rehearse, you know, you have to practice. The same way you have to be disciplined, you know, you have to rest, you have to eat well. You know, you do have to take care of yourself when you compete. And also sing and have fun.
And Gonzalez's Thoroughbreds take the stage. The girls are in red Santa gowns. The boys are wearing Santa caps to go with red bow ties and suspenders. They're dancing on the steps of an office building in the backdrop of a giant 32-foot poinsettia, one of the largest of its kind in the world. The hulking red tree was a gift to the city of Coral Gables in 1987 that inspired the competition. Hialeah High's rendition of this holiday standard is watched closely by a team of judges, including retired music teacher Judy Berger.
First of all, it's a visual. Do they look good? Do they follow their thing? And then you listen for perfection. You listen for the fact that they have good intonation, that they pronounce their words well, that they make the songs mean something, and that they're just not drones. You want it to sound like it's holiday music and not just, okay, I learned this song and now let me sing it.
And Hialeah has some stiff competition. Everglades Senior High has over 100 members in its choir rolling merrily along. Fellow judge Rafael de Guzman says just like on any field or court, teamwork matters.
I mean, they have to be listening to each other, and the movement has to be precise and in unison. This is a friendly competition, but there is an accountability, just like in sports.
Last up, the biggest and perhaps most formidable squad of carolers from Coral Park Senior High with their own twist on a Christmas classic.
Misfortune seemed his lot. We got into a drifting bank and then we got upsot. Upsot. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
In the end, 28 schools shared over $11,000 in cash prizes, with Hialeah again taking home first prize in the show choir division, and Everglades and Coral Reef sharing top honors in the full choir division. But there were good tidings for all, and according to Hialeah High's Jaylene Fernandez, no losers.
We could all have fun, and we all enjoy it so much that I don't see it as a competition. I see it more as bonding.
While sports and choir may have some things in common, these choir members say there is one noticeable difference.
Is there any trash talking involved here? Trash singing, maybe? No?
No, there's never.
That I know of, not really.
Never. We always, usually when other choirs see us, they say, oh my God, you guys did so good, and we share like good comments or good feedback, never anything bad.
Where's the fun if you trash talk other people?
Perhaps pro athletes can take a cue from amateur carolers.
Let's send you off with a happy holiday wish in the form of bells.
For Only a Game, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
The 65-foot-tall loblolly pine known as the Eisenhower tree was cut down and removed from Augusta's 17th hole after it was damaged in an ice storm. The tree earned its nickname because it didn't like Ike. Dwight Eisenhower hit it so many times between 1948 and 1969 that he lobbied to have the loblolly removed. He was overruled by then-Augusta chairman Clifford Roberts, and the tree stood until February of 2014, at which point many wondered what Augusta would do with it. Shortly thereafter, I was joined on the program by golf legend and three-time Masters champion Gary Player, who remembered the legendary conifer.
Thank you very much, Bill, and it's quite sad, but there's always a good side and a bad side, and I'm sure President Eisenhower up there in heaven will say, at last, I've got my wish. But that tree has got a lot of history attached to it. I remember playing there almost 60 years ago, and Sam Snead used to just cream it right over that tree, and he told Bobby Cole about that, and Bobby Cole said, how is it possible? He says, well, it was only 12 foot high when I did it. But the tree, it really was a very significant tree. It was over 100 years old. Not only was it, 65 feet high, but it was up on a hill, which really made it close to 80 foot. What should they do? Well, Augusta, they can build a practice tee worth $100 million, which nobody else can do. They just go up and buy all the houses and make a practice tee out of it. So they can easily replace that tree. And I'm sure there's a big tree somewhere, and they could go in there, and please believe me, they can replace that tree, which I'm sure they'll do.
Well, I'm wondering if Dwight Eisenhower was the only golfer not fond of that tree. There must have been lots of other golfers who had things to say about it. Now, keeping in mind that we're public radio and children may be listening, what have you heard other players say about that tree?
I think basically people are sad that it's gone, even though it might have hurt them. But it wasn't the tree's fault. I mean, it was the golfer's fault. A lot of people like to give the tree the blame. But if you kicked out on the fairway, you liked it. If it stayed up there, you hated it. And many times the ball actually stayed in the tree because it was so thickly grown together.
So what you're telling me is if somebody were to go through the rubble left over from that tree, they'd find not only splinters they could sell on eBay, but also golf balls.
I remember they had a tree in San Francisco at the U.S. Open course, and the tree was cut down, and they found something like 50 golf balls in it. So you don't want to tell many people that because they'll be out with their saw at night.
Have you any favorite or perhaps least favorite hazards on other courses among the many that you've played over the years?
Hazards I always find are the challenging part of the game of golf. And I like all these hazards. I mean, the 13th hole at Augusta has that hazard right in front of the green. But the 13th hole at Augusta one year, I went for the green, and there was a pipe, a drainage pipe that stuck out underneath the green into the hazard by about 2 feet, and my ball landed against that. And luckily, I got a drop, and I chipped it up and held the putt and went on to win the tournament. So, hazards sometimes are good to you and sometimes they're bad. But if they're bad, you cannot complain because There's no hazard in the middle of the green.
You and your firm have designed more than 300 golf courses in 35 different countries. What is it about the design at Augusta National that keeps people interested enough to worry about whether a tree is going to be replaced?
It's the first major championship, Bill, of the year, and it's a paradise. I mean, I've always said if there's a golf course in heaven, it's got to look like Augusta, and I hope that I'm the head pro there one day, but I'm not in a hurry to tee off yet. But I've always said that's what it would look like. It's a paradise. The whole atmosphere of Augusta, it really exemplifies great beauty, great tradition, great excitement, first major, all the screaming and echoing through those valleys, and the fact that it had President Eisenhower and Bobby Jones and Clifford Roberts and a lot of phenomenal great champions throughout history that have won there. It's something very, very special.
Now, I have to get back to President Eisenhower for just one final question. He complained about this tree, and he learned that as president, he was not the most powerful man in the United States as far as trees at Augusta were concerned, because that was Cliff Roberts.
Right.
Was Eisenhower just a bad golfer?
No, he was pretty good off his handicap. He was a wonderful man, and Arnold Palmer and I had dinner with him one night at up in La Trobe, and he just loved golf, which is a great blessing, because so many presidents, President Kennedy, President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, you can go back to all of them. They all loved golf. So here I'm nearly 80, and I can beat my age by at least 8 to 10 shots a day. I can still play well. I won a tournament at 63. Other sports, you're 30 and you're gone.
Gary Player was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame 40 years ago, and he has 165 tournament victories to his credit, including 9 major championships on the regular PGA Tour. Gary, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a delight.
Thank you so much, Bill. Take care, my friend.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Gary Player, who cites a NASA lunar mission as proof of golf's universality.
What did the man on the moon do when he arrived there? He didn't kick a football, he hit a golf ball.
Well, of course not. Have you seen those clunky moon boots? Not even Adam Vinatieri could hit a short field goal with those things, assuming NASA could wrest him away from the NFL. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.